everyone, and welcome to Dark Natter, the podcast where we stalk a piece of dark fiction and take it down before it can liberate any other goddamn skin jobs. were you not a bit early with that?
I don't know, I just thought it was funny.
It was funny, it was definitely funny. But normally you would withhold your laughter until we explain where today's piece of dark fiction is vying to get...
Hall of Pain!
That's it, that what you said. Maybe you should just do the intro, it's a lot more concise. Do you want to go?
Lockdown, it's lockdown, buddy. I'm going out of my mind, yeah.
Is lockdown getting to you psychologically?
Absolutely. It's like a piece of dark fiction, you could say.
It resembles it strongly, doesn't it? Desolate streets, crap hair. Well, not in your case, but, you know.
Well, it is crap, yeah. I wish I had crap
hair. Hey, come on, man. It suits
thanks
you.
Thanks for reminding me of that.
Oh, God. I wish I hadn't done it. That's it now. He was all in a good mood. Now he's going to be sad. Grieving for that hair for the rest of the show.
I'm bald, by the way.
Well, as I talk as if I'm not bald, I am rapidly approaching baldness. I mean, at least you've had the good grace to get rid of the remnants. I'm still clinging on to them as if there's some, you know, it's basic. What did my brother describe it as? The ghost of some hair. That's what he said. Bastard.
Anyway, where were we?
Well, as always, one of us will be pitching to t'other a piece of dark fiction, whether that's a film, a book, a video game, an album, a Disney World ride, or some other bollocks, something that vaguely qualifies as dark fiction will be vying for a place adjudicated by the other panelist in the hallowed, horrible hallways of the Hall of Pain. Oh, you son of a... That's where the laugh normally goes, isn't it? You see?
You've had a laugh out of me today. I'm not doing another one.
Fair enough. I can't ask for any more. You're only working at like 60% capacity as well because of the lockdown.
Absolutely, yeah.
You've got to be kind
to yourself.
I mean,
I was only ever at 70% anyway. Yeah,
you're doing
beforehand,
60% of 70%, whatever that is.
And I believe it's this week it's your turn to pitch to me...
You're goddamn
so,
right.
What say ye, punk?
Well, you may have... Oh, well, it's interesting you say punk. Because today we're going to be discussing a stalwart, a linchpin, almost, a founding text of the cyberpunk genre, which is Blade Runner and the sequel. And the sequel as well, because the sequel's dead good, but we'll come to that.
Okay. And this is particularly timely for you because this has been very influential to your work. Am I right in saying that?
Thank you for the segue. You are indeed. This is nothing at all to do. This is not cynically timed in any way. No, I've got a book out. At the time of recording, the book is out tomorrow. So by the time this airs, it will have been out for, I don't know, a week or something. So it's dead stressful because you've got people lined up to, you know, like I've got a blog tour that it's on for a week. So a load of bloggers, one or two a day, will read the book and they'll review it. So you don't know whether you're staring down the barrel of a week of like lovely praise that makes you feel good about yourself and reasonable sales or terrible sales and being slagged off every day for a week. You have no idea which way it's going to go. But yeah, fingers crossed.
And what's it called? Did you say what it was called?
Oh yeah, it's called. I'll do a big advert at the end. But
okay.
I'll quickly mention it in case people stop listening before the end.
Which they normally do.
Which I'm convinced they do. It's London 2039 Auxiliary is the name of the book. So it is a cyberpunk thriller set in a dystopian future vision of London. So hopefully that's up your dark neon-soaked alley, listeners. But yeah, I'll plug it later.
And of course, the original Blade Runner was also set in a dystopian future of sorts, albeit now in the past, 2019, I believe.
It was, yeah. I think there's a thing about using the ninth year of a decade sounds coolest. Hence yeah, the reason I did it. Yeah. But yeah, that's why I wanted to pitch Blade Runner, is because it massively influenced this novel, massively influenced on me. It is an incredible film. So very, very keen to talk through that. And then happily, it spawned eventually, you know, long overdue in many ways. Yeah. Oh, not so much long overdue. Completely unexpected, out of the blue. I don't think anyone thought it would ever have one or should have had one.
Yeah, certainly after that amount of time, yeah.
But it got a sequel. So the original Blade Runner came out in 1982. And then the sequel was 2017. And we'll perhaps come onto the sequel later, but certainly the first film is regarded as almost like a founding text of cyberpunk as a genre, alongside the book New Romancer by William Gibson, which I've read and is ace. What's your kind of cyberpunk sort of history, Liam? Have you, obviously you've seen Blade Runner, but have you seen or read more widely in the genre?
No, not really. No.
I don't know, it's one of those words.
Well,
there's loads, and if you Google it, there's shitloads of cyberpunk books, but there's not many that are regarded as, you know, sort of seminal works, must reads. And there's actually that slightly annoying debate about, oh, that's not cyberpunk. Yes, it is. No, it's not.
Well, to be fair, that's kind of why I didn't say anything, because have I read, watched, played much cyberpunk stuff? Probably, but it's whether or not, you know,
it technically is or not. And yeah, obviously that's just silly gatekeeping bollocks, isn't it? But, you know, you've got to, I suppose, there's got to be some criteria, because otherwise genres wouldn't exist. So in some ways, loosely, it's cyberpunk, I guess, is future, usually quite near future, where it is a dystopian urban setting, so big city.
Yeah.
The phrase they always use is high tech, low life.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got, you know, big corporations vying for control, and strong elements of the noir kind of detective genre.
Yeah.
Like some people would argue, I have seen them argue online, that to be cyberpunk, it has to have a detective in it. So.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. So even things like, I don't know, The Matrix, which might strike you as cyberpunk, because it's not a detective thriller, technically it isn't. Whereas Ghost in the Shell...
Well, I was going to say Ghost in the Shell.
Brilliant example. Like, to me, that ticks all the boxes. It's police detectives investigating a mystery against a bleak future dystopian urban backdrop. The other element I should mention is it's got to have strong elements of technology. Not necessarily negative, but just very present. So, you know, metal arms and prosthetic jaws and laser eyeballs and all that kind of stuff.
I suppose for me, yeah, so probably my first kind of foray into whether or not we'll get into that debate now if class is a cyberpunk or not, but yeah, probably Akira.
I mean, I put to me definitely is that the setting is so strongly of the cyberpunk kind of ilk, that it's that like real neon lit kind of grubby, grimy, seedy underbelly of the big city. What is it? Neo Tokyo, or I can't remember if I got that right, but I think that's where it's set. And yeah, like biker gangs dominating the city, like crime ridden streets.
Yeah.
Dark. It's what a film. Brilliant.
And then maybe the Syndicate video game, bit later on, Deus Ex. I mean, would you... Final Fantasy VII, kind of the city of Midgar,
see,
I think is...
I was thinking about that the other day. I think it does qualify.
Yeah, but that's the thing, does it? Or certainly elements of it.
Yeah, people. In other words, some people will go, yeah, damn right it qualifies. And other people go, no, knobheads, of course it doesn't. You're stupid. And it doesn't matter. Who cares? To an extent, as long as something's got some of those elements, I think it, you know... I think it's in. It's just a final one, actually. RoboCop. I don't know why that doesn't really count. It's got tech in. It's in a grimy, seedy future city. And it's got a detective in who's basically investigating his own murder. It's like the most perfect story you could imagine in that kind of set of criteria. But
what a film as well.
It Why are we not doing that?
Let's just switch gears and
that's a massive error. Well, no, Blade Runner is brilliant as well, but RoboCop, yeah.
I'll tell you a good one, actually. I've never actually played this. I've got it now after years and years of always wanting it. It's a video game called Snatcher, which I remember it came out on the Mega CD. I think it was out on the PC Engine before then. But it's a Hideo Kojima game, actually. And it's kind of like visual novel kind of cyberpunk.
Yeah, from like the 80s or something.
Yeah, it came out in the 90s for the Mega CD, which was when I first became aware of it. But I do have it now, so I'm going to have to go back and play that. But yeah, that's another sort of early example of cyberpunk in my life.
I saw a bit of it. I think Hayden, our mutual friend who's got every console ever that's ever been made and every video game in every nationality. And I saw a bit of it at his house and it looked quite good. But it just makes you realise, like, Hideo Kojima is really old, isn't he? He's been going for ages and he looks younger than me, the bastard. Oh, never mind. Good on him.
Fifth Element, would you...
I'm having it. It's in. Yeah. It definitely counts.
Aesthetically, anyway, it's...
It's got that, like, sort of...
He was a taxi driver there, wasn't he, in that?
Yeah, with his... He had bleached hair. And thingy, Mila Jovovich, she was... What's that thing she says in it? Pass, multi-pass, multi-pass. Is that it?
Can't remember.
She was lovely in that film, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Very likeable lass. Oh, sorry. We're just listing cyberpunk things for 15 minutes. But bloody Flashback on the Mega Drive.
Yeah, yeah. I never played that when it came out, but yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Did you only ever play it kind of retrospectively then?
Yes, yeah.
That was probably the first cyberpunk thing I ever experienced was that game, actually, because I used to rent it from the spa that I'd like, you could rent a Mega Drive game for £3 for the weekend. Don't know why my parents didn't just buy it for me. I said cheapskates, they probably couldn't afford it, so that's not a very nice thing to say.
You'd spoil it, brat.
Yes, little prick. I got all the passwords off, you know, like a magazine, like Games Master. And so I could start the beginning of every level. And then apart from one level, I just got stuck within about two screens. And I used to rent it, try and do all the bits I couldn't do, give up, play through the same one level again. It was still ace. I suppose we should move on to talking about Blade Runner then, really.
We should.
Given that we've been going for a quarter of an hour.
And probably going to keep remembering other cyberpunk things and when they entered our lives. But yeah, more than perhaps I realised. But yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, it does go back a long time, really, cyberpunk.
Altered Carbon. Sorry. There's another one. Good book.
Sorry, I missed that. What was that?
Altered Carbon. You ever read that or watch that show?
I'm aware of it, but I've never...
Good book. It's a good book. The series is like, yeah. So what we thought we would do for this episode is instead of... So what we usually do is recap the plot of a thing because that gives us a helpful sort of narrative thrust for the episode and... gives us an opportunity to kind of go off on sidelines and prompts us to think of things. But the problem with that structure is that you've probably seen it. You probably already know the story. So you're not going to benefit a lot from us recapping it, apart from in a kind of nostalgic way. But because there's quite a lot to cover narratively across these two films, and we've used up most of our runtime talking bollocks, we thought we would try a different approach today. So, you know, let us know, sound off in the comments if you don't like it. But the plan is we're just going to assume you've seen the films. So if you have seen them, listen away. And if you haven't seen them, then you stop listening and go and watch them because they're both amazing. And what are you doing? What do you think, Liam? Does it sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan to me.
So?
I mean, apart from the stop listening bit...
Yeah. Oh
don't,
shit!
Don't
yeah,
worry
don't
about
stop.
Watching the film. Just listen to this instead. You'll get a gist of what's going on.
What about this? Put the films on, but on mute, and listen to us talking instead.
I think that's a good idea.
Good compromise. And obviously, our voices are much more, you know, seductive and manly than Harrison Ford's. Anyway.
And Ford, his voice is quite important because he really sets the kind of mood, doesn't he? The sort of noir detective style.
Spot on. That narration over the top is a trope of the kind of noir genre, and they lean on that heavily, or at least they lean on it heavily in the original theatrical version, but not in the director's cut. And that's probably an important point we've stumbled into, which is that there are shitloads of different versions of the original Blade Runner, which gets a bit tiresome. But the version I have rewatched recently as prep for this is the Ridley Scott, the director, his cut of the film, which does have some key differences to what was originally shown in cinemas. So, to summarise the different versions, the 1982 original work print that apparently failed dismally in audience tests and was not released has no voiceover from Deckard. It does not have a grafted-on happy ending, and it does not feature the unicorn dream, which we'll come back to. The US theatrical release does have the voiceovers that you alluded to, Liam. It has, sadly, a grafted-on happy ending where Deckard and Rachel drive through the countryside, but it does not feature the unicorn dream. The 1982 international release apparently is the same, but just has a bit more violence in certain scenes, which is weird. Then you've got the 1992 director's cut. So sorry, I misspoke. The 1992 director's cut was not done by Ridley Scott, but was approved by him. That scraps the voiceovers. It scraps the happy ending. So it ends after Deckard and Rachel leave Deckard's flat. And it does include the famous unicorn dream, which we'll come back to. And then the 2007 final cut, which is Ridley Scott's actual final official version, has got the same content as the director's cut, plus a new scene where Deckard is at the piano and outside the club, so a new bit. Doesn't add a great deal, in my opinion. And then many technical improvements, one of which is that really weird fuck-up that they made with counting the number of replicants. I don't know if you remember this, but in the film, when he's having his noodles, isn't he, at the kind of cyberpunk Japanese noodle bar in the middle of, you know, future LA, and he gets kind of like nobbled by these two police sort of thug types, and they're like, the captain wants to see you, and one of them is that really cool guy with a tash whose name I can't remember, and he appears not to speak English at that point. And anyway, Deckard kind of caves in and goes along with him to see the captain, and the captain's that like fat alcoholic slob guy and he's supping his like whiskies, all these like noir detective kind of cliches, it's so good. And he's like, hey, we got six skin jobs on the loose, and it just gets completely the wrong number. I think he says there's six skin jobs but one of them got fried. Well, that would leave five, but then there's only four in the film. It's like, what? How did they manage to cock that up?
Yeah, I'd noticed that, actually, yeah.
So, yeah, they just took the opportunity, I guess, to fix those. So, yeah, you may as well, if you're going to watch it, watch, if you can, the final cut, or at the very least, watch the director's cut. Although, having said all of that, I quite miss that voiceover narration when it was taken out.
I like the voiceover narration, yeah.
Me too. So maybe just watch any version, it doesn't matter, they're all ace.
Well, maybe just, yeah, watch any one and then realise how good it is and then watch all of the others.
Yeah, it's an excuse to watch the film five times, yeah, isn't it?
Exactly.
At least. But yeah, it's so good. So let's try and focus in on that. What is it that makes this film so good, so renowned, so iconic, so well-reviewed and well-regarded critically as well as, you know, sort of universally almost?
Well, it's your pitch, mate. You tell me.
Oh, shit. I was trying to get you to do all the work. I was like the captain and you were like Deckard then. I was trying to get you to do all the dirty work. One of the many great things about the film is just the cast and the performances. So it does have all the right people in all the right roles.
Agree with
you
that.
You know, you've got Harrison. Harrison Ford just does a great job. Like, he's kind of an underrated actor in my opinion. Like, I know his career, in some ways, all of his characters have kind of converged and become a bit the same. Like Han Solo and Indiana Jones are kind of the same person now. Yeah. Certainly, they were in the later outings. But Deckard is basically a piece of shit.
Yeah.
He's like a womanizing alcoholic.
I mean, there is a scene later on in the film, actually. I don't know if we're going to talk about it too much, where he kind of rapes.
Yeah, it's a bit weird, isn't it?
Forces himself.
It's a very
aggressive,
aggressive sex scene where it isn't really clear that consent has occurred, and it's just a bit weird to watch that bit.
Yeah,
and yeah, at no point does he come across as a nice bloke that you're supposed to kind of sympathise with. He just seems like a bit
sort of selfish.
Yeah, kind of unpleasant, seedy kind of. He's really immersed in this city and this lifestyle. And he's also very easily persuaded, isn't he? Like, oh, I don't do that Blade Running lark anymore. Oh, go on. Okay. All right, then. So, and then he gets described as like a killing machine at one point, doesn't he?
Yeah.
By the captain. So it's almost like, has he got a bit of a taste for this, despite his apparent kind of reticence? He must get some thrill out of retiring these replicants that he's hunting down. But yeah, Harrison Ford, brilliant. Rutger Hauer,
oh.
Jesus God, oh my God, so good.
Is this his best ever film role?
Yeah, by miles. I've seen him in I've seen him in quite a few things, and he's a very charismatic man. So he always is kind of like, hey, it's Rutger Hauer, but I don't think I've ever seen him necessarily give a great performance in any... I can't think of anything else that springs to mind. Oh, Rutger Hauer was amazing in that film. Whereas in this, like, can you imagine anyone else playing this part? It would just be crap.
No, I agree with that. Wanted Dead or Alive. Do you remember when we watched that?
Yeah. I mean, that is worth a watch for different reasons, isn't it?
There's a great bit in that when he butters his bread. He does a bit of toast. And he's such a macho man that he doesn't just, you know, spread it with a knife.
Basically, he doesn't use a knife.
The toast on a knob of butter. That's how he spreads his toast. So good.
He gets his block of butter out of the fridge. He pings the toast. He's wearing at this point like a tight-fitting, like a silk dressing gown.
Yeah, pretty sure he's just shagged someone, hasn't he?
Isn't he trying to impress a woman? Or he's like, maybe she's just slept with him because he's the hero and whatever.
Possibly.
He's trying to look dead hard, and he just like nonchalantly gets this one slice of toast and then just rubs it on the directly onto the butter. Like, who does that? Well, he does.
So clearly,
Rutger does. Or Nick. That was his name, wasn't it? Nick!
He was good. Oh, yeah, that's it, yeah. Nick!
Shit. Oh, so okay. Shit. But the thing is, he did end up doing loads of those, like, crap parody joke films. Like, not that I'm saying this particular one is a bad film, but he's in Hobo with a Shotgun
in his later life.
And it's like,
which is arguably the best of all those Grindhouse films
that came out
around that time. But
his pedigree, his career didn't follow the trajectory that one would expect for someone that was in such a high profile.
But he has been in a lot of stuff that I kind of like, though.
Yeah.
But I do agree with you. This is definitely, I think,
the pinnacle of his career. This is the pinnacle of his career, sadly.
I don't think you could really argue with that.
He was, final comment on stuff that he's done, was he was in that video game Observer, which was described by one review as like 9 out of 10, Blade Runner meets Silent Hill, which is like my two favourite things. Jesus
dream, isn't it,
Christ, yeah. I was like, right, immediately bought it. And it is good. And he does a good gravel-throated job in it. But it's not perfect. It's not quite as good as I was hoping for, maybe.
Yeah, and it's not as good as its influences.
And then he sadly passed away not long after that. So yeah, that's a shame. But yeah, he's amazing in this film. Obviously, one of the most famous ad-libs of all time with his tears in rain line. He just sort of made up off the cuff because the actual script was some waffly load of bollocks that he presumably couldn't be asked to learn.
I didn't know that. That was.
Oh, did you not know that was an ad lib?
No.
Yeah, man. If you Google it when you can be bothered, it's like the actual script is okay, and it's like quite a long paragraph, and he just gives it the old C-beams. I watched C-beams glitter in the dark at the Tannhauser Gate. I've seen attack ships on fire off the shores of Orion. All these memories will be lost in time like tears in rain. He just made that up. Like that. Wow. What a guy. I'll definitely, what's the word, cut that in here.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
And yeah, that's probably the most memorable line in the film, isn't it?
Yeah, brilliant. And I always think that what's-his-name, bloke with a tash, he probably was supposed to have the best line, because then he... This is the point when Roy Batty spares Deckard's life, because he's clearly got the jump on him, and instead of killing him, he just allows him to survive and dies himself, and we know that he's dead because that dove flies off and that amazing bit of music plays, amazing, amazing. And then shortly after, when Deckard's buggering off, the moustache guy turns up to pick him up in one of those hovering cop cars, and he gives it the, it's too bad she won't live, but then again, who does? Like, that's a good line, but it just is completely overshadowed by...
Overshadowed, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh, he kind of stole his thunder there.
When you said the moustache guy, I thought you were talking about his little mate, Leon, who... is also ace in this film.
Yeah, he is ace. Although, I'm not sure he's little. I think he's a whopper.
Oh, no. I don't mean little. I just mean
no, but it's
mate.
Funny you say that, because I kind of... When I was young, I never had an appreciation of or a perception of who was big and powerful and who was, like, little and not powerful. It's hard to explain. So, like, now as an adult man... It's kind of obvious when you walk into a room. Oh, I wouldn't mess with him. He's massive. Oh, I reckon I could take him. He's a short ass. Do you know what I mean? But yeah. So maybe at the time when I watched this first, I wouldn't have thought of Leon as being quite.
I didn't literally mean little though. Just
sorry. I've gone off on a tangent.
I'm just saying his little mate. You know, like his.
Like he's
just a figure of speech.
Like he's little in reputation. I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. To clarify, Leon's clearly at least 10 feet tall. I don't know. And so
when he's fighting Deckard, he
batters him, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he does look really tough there. But initially, when he's just being interviewed, he just looks like a bit of a slob.
He comes in and he's like, "Hey, what's this? What's this?"
He looks
bloody,
quite hard later on.
Hey, Doc, what are we doing? But see, that's another thing. So. Deckard in that scene, in the scene with Roy Batty, basically in every scene, he's not particularly capable or good at his... He's not depicted as being particularly good at his job. He's a bit... He gets overpowered by the replicants. He's lucky to survive most of the encounters. He's particularly lucky to survive his encounter with Leon because he just gets pummeled until Rachel turns up and shoots Leon in the head from the back, from behind. And so, yeah, we're not really given any reason to root for Deckard at all.
Same with Batty, and he survives Batty.
I know,
he lets him.
And which is amazing. Like, what a, you know, a transcendent kind of... Deckard has literally just slaughtered all his mates and his missus, and yet he decides to spare him and almost kind of teach him a lesson. You know, it's not nice to live in fear, is it? What a great...
Yeah, that is
although, I quite like the less altruistic side of Roy Batty when he horribly tortures the poor old Chinese bloke who makes the eyeballs.
Yeah.
Like, that's really horrid, that scene, isn't it? That's where we get some of the stuff about showcasing the replicants' capabilities, because they're fine in the cold and in the cold. The guy's literally freezing to death in his own lab because they've stripped him of his warm jacket. He looks like he's about to die, and they're just kind of laughing and sticking like those eyeballs on his shoulders and stuff.
Yeah, Leon.
Horrible, horrible things. And then there's later we get the flip side of that, where they're juggling like boiling hot eggs because they can, again, they've got powers of survival.
Because they can.
So yeah, Rutger Hauer, amazing. All the rest of the cast, fantastic job. Daryl Hannah, yeah. Even like the guy, J.F. Sebastian, the little kind of, he's got Methuselah syndrome, which means he ages prematurely. And I forget the actor's name. I will Google it. And
William Sanderson.
Well done. Yeah, William Sanderson. He's perfect for that part again.
Yeah, he really is, actually, yeah. Yeah, he's very good casting.
Yeah. And then, obviously, beyond just the cast and the characters, you've got the actual setting and that, like, incredible sort of dark, grimy, steam vent gushing
wet, neon,
yeah, pissing it down. Like, just, it is so good, that vision of, like, a city of the future. I went to the secret cinema of Blade Runner, and they basically managed to knock it up quite convincingly in a warehouse. It was one of the best things I've ever done in my life.
Wow.
I've heard mixed things about secret cinema. I've heard people have been to it and had like thought it was a bit crap. The Blade Runner one was absolutely amazing. I would, if they ever redid.
When did they do that? Probably
3 years ago.
I think I heard about secret cinema, God, maybe 5 years ago, but then it suddenly exploded and like it suddenly became not a secret anymore.
Yeah, just
do you know what I mean? It used to be the thing that like if you were quite cool, you knew about it. And then I'm not sure when it was. Maybe it was the Back to the Future one or Star Wars one, but suddenly it became. So was it kind of pre that or post?
I think it was post it becoming famous because I am not cool. So I definitely only heard of it once it had become a bit more mainstream. But yeah, I just was like, oh, Blade Runner. Oh, all right. Fuck it. I'll sign up for this. And you got all this like preamble stuff about, you know, this is your character and you're a detective and you're a replicant. It was like, so this happened, right? I know you're not supposed to talk about the secret cinema and give spoilers, so I'll shut up in a minute. But this was good. So there was this whole kind of hour or so where you were just knocking about in the reconstructed city before you went in and watched the film. And there's, you know, loads of other people. But then there's, like, kind of actors. They had a really convincing... James Hong is the actor who plays the Chinese dude who makes the eyeballs. He was David Lo Pan in Big Trouble in Little China.
That's right, yeah.
They had a really good kind of look-alike, sound-alike of him. They had, like, a bar with people in there that were kind of, like, coming up to you and offering you the work and, like, telling you, asking you, could you find out who was a replicant? So there was a bit of, like, role-play stuff. And then there was someone who was trying to get their hand on like plant life and they were offering you like memories in return if you could get them a flower. And I think you were supposed to go and do something to acquire this flower. But I'd bought a cocktail that had like a sprig of, I don't know, like some green bollocks in it. So I offered them that for a memory and they looked at it and were like, yep. So I got this bit of currency that I could then go and spend. It was really, it was great. I really loved it.
Yeah, sounds good.
So yeah, you've got the kind of setting and maybe there hadn't been anything quite like it. Great cast, great performances. The soundtrack is brilliant.
Very ahead of its time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rewatching it, I was quite surprised because I think when I first watched it, I was probably sort of 18 at the time. Probably didn't really pay much attention to stuff like that. Well, probably stoned to be honest.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But rewatching it for the podcast, I was quite surprised by the soundtrack.
Yeah,
it was really. I don't know. I just thought, God, that could play on anything today.
Yeah, Vangelis was the I don't know, the architect of the soundscape. But yeah, it was incredible stuff. Like, it gives it almost this weird kind of timeless kind of quality. It's got like a kind of dated, sad, melancholy feel, but also feels very synthy and kind of futuristic. It's just, really unique. And then, another element of the film, I suppose, is the quite ambiguous story, which was made much more ambiguous in the subsequent director's cuts that we talked about. So just to explain, we alluded earlier to the unicorn scene. So Deckard falls asleep at one point during the case, hunting down the replicants that he's been tasked with retiring. And he has a dream about a unicorn and like a weird white horse with a big pointy, you know what a unicorn is, you know, he's running about in slow motion, and then he wakes up and the film goes on. Meanwhile, we've established that Mustache Guy has got a gimmick where he does origami and makes little paper animals and shit, and then and leaves them, almost like his calling card. And then right at the end of the film, after Batty is dead, all the replicants are dead, Deckard's been given a lift home, you know, he's deemed to be a success, except we know that the police know that Rachel has done a runner from the Tyrell Corporation, and we know she's a replicant. We know that she has, we pretty much know that she has realised that she's a replicant, which is that really sad bit where he, it's horrible, it's Deckard again. He tells her, so she turns up ranting and raving, like, how can you accuse me of being a machine or a, you know, artificial? And then he tells her two of her, like, closest, most secret memories that he couldn't possibly know. And then afterwards he feels a bit guilty and he's like, oh, bad joke. I didn't mean it. I was only
clearly
joking.
Clearly, he wouldn't know that.
Yeah. Unless, it's like, the damage is done, you bastard. And then has sex with her. Like, what a dick. But, okay, he does fall in love with her. So he goes home. We kind of think maybe she's going to have died at the same limited life expectancy that all the replicants suffer from.
Yeah, I was going to say, you probably need to point that out, that replicants are outlawed and they have a limited lifespan.
Yeah, they've been built.
Actually, we don't need to do that because we're assuming people have already watched
it. But a reminder is helpful. Oh, it's a helpful reminder. But yeah, they have a 4-year lifespan. So Roy Batty's just died of this lifespan kind of terminus, goes back to his apartment, but she's still okay, she's still there. And then, you know, he realizes that they're going to be hunted down because everyone suspects he's got Rachel with him. He's harboring this escaped replicant. And there's just a little paper unicorn been left behind outside his flat. And what that implies is that, well, how could anyone know what Deckard dreams about? Unless Deckard is a replicant and that is what that is telling him. And it's maybe the idea is that Mustache Dude knows he's a replicant and thinks it's a bit hard on him and wants him to escape and is letting him know, hey man, you're a replicant. You and your replicant missus should do a runner and I wish you well, potentially. So it's a real kind of ambiguous ending that I totally didn't get when I was younger.
No. It's funny, though, because even the one without the dream, there are a few hints throughout the film that maybe he is a replicant because he keeps going on about feelings.
Yeah.
Saying, I can't think the exact quote, but kind of basically saying, oh, they're getting feelings now. It's like, so am I. You know, like he's kind of...
There's a few...
I need to think of the quote, but... it's sort of, if you put it this way, you can make that fit that narrative that he is a replicant himself. So,
and what's genius is, in some ways, you can make it fit both. So you could argue, well, he gets overpowered easily by replicants throughout the film, so he's obviously not a replicant, because why does he get beaten up? Counter argument, they all know they're replicants and he doesn't know. So maybe he literally doesn't know his own strength. And also, he does get overpowered, battered around, chucked all over the place by replicants, but he seems to shrug it off quite easily. Yeah. So maybe he is, you know, much stronger than...
Yeah.
So there's the thing about the red eye, the sort of whatever you call it, when you get red eye in a photo, they use that in loads of the shots of replicants like Rachel, where they've got that kind of red eye glare. But then, sort of as if almost that's like a tell, for, but just for us, fourth wall breaking. But then Deckard has them at one point. So it's like, is Scott trying to tell us? Well, I think he actually did say in an interview at some point, I'm going to just check that. Is Deckard a replicant?
I was going to say, what do you think?
Google says, according to several interviews with Scott, Deckard is a replicant.
Okay.
I personally think that the film doesn't tell us explicitly that he is. And I like that it's ambiguous.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll tell you what, though. I like that it's ambiguous, but I like thinking that he is one.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like, yeah. I want him to be one?
Yeah, I want him to be one, but I like that it isn't confirmed.
It's, yeah, yeah.
And then, this is probably a neat segue in many ways. I'm not sure if we answered the question of why is Blade Runner so good, but we should move on to the sequel. One of the best decisions they made in Blade Runner 2049, among many good decisions, is not telling us whether Deckard is a replicant or not. They kept it. They kept the mystery, which is a great idea, I think.
And you're right, yeah, the old 2049, the nine again.
Yeah, the end of a decade. It's cooler. It's the coolest year. 1999, that was a cool year, I guess. Blade Runner 2049 is a... Well, Denis Villeneuve directed it, not Ridley Scott. And I remember seeing the trailer and thinking, this looks like a load of shit. Like,
oh, really?
I thought it looked like a cash-in, an unnecessary sequel, and the trailer, I still maintain to this day, that the trailer made it look like it was just a big action blockbuster.
Well, that is true. I thought that's what it was going to be. I thought it would be, you know, not a dumbed down, maybe not the word, but yeah, fuck it, let's go dumbed down. I just thought it would be a kind of, you know, futuristic sort of action movie with
Star Wars.
Because now they can do really great special effects.
Yeah, so I went to the cinema to watch it because I really wanted to see what they'd done, but I had really low expectations. And then I came out 3 hours later and was like, holy shit, that was absolutely brilliant. I couldn't believe it. I absolutely loved it. I don't know if you had quite as strong reaction as me. Probably not.
Well, I don't know if you remember, but I, myself and our mutual friend Hayden were really fucking with you about it because we lived together at the time and
nope,
you kept saying about, you kept going on about how great it was, and we were both kind of on our sort of group chat thing.
Wankers.
We were really, yeah, really laying on like, oh no, it looks shit. And I went to see it with my partner.
Yeah, pair of jerks.
And I was quite drunk when I got there. I'd had quite a few drinks already and I fell asleep.
Oh, God.
So she was really annoyed because it was her pick. And I do get why, because it's a little bit... You know when you watch a film with someone and it's kind of like your pick and you really want them to like it?
Yep.
And not that she had seen it before, but, you know, it was her pick and we went to the cinema. And there I am, kind of, I doze off only for, you know, 5-10 minutes or so. And I'm just acting really belligerent and drunk. No, actually, no, I'm not acting like that. That makes me sound like some sort of...
Yeah, you're not. I don't think you're that bad.
But needless to say, I wasn't paying attention as much as I should have been.
And yeah, once you've zoned out of a film and nodded off a bit, you've gone, haven't you? You're not engaged. You're not going to be like, wow, that was the best film ever. You'll be like, yeah, it was okay.
But in fairness, I did enjoy it. And having rewatched it is very good. It is very good.
It's even, you know, the opening scene, it was almost like all my doubts and fears were just dispelled within the first 10 or 15 minutes because you've got amazing, brilliant soundtrack by Zimmer. You know, I know he's like the go-to soundtrack guy now, but it is incredible, like sort of, you've got that big, the word cinematic, but it's like that great big shot of that kind of interesting wasteland that he's flying across. You've got that sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's still got elements of melancholy, but it's still quite, it's kind of like grand grand tragic kind of sound, and then you're wondering where he's going and who is he, and then he parks up at that you've got the big guy's, you know, in the big sort of biohazard suit, and he's pulling big fat squirming maggots out of some disgusting toxic slop, and then he takes his helmet off and, oh my god, it's Batista the wrestler. But he looks, I don't know if he just is old because he is like 50, but he looked, I don't know whether they aged him even more, he looked very old and grey, and, you know, kind of almost like he had that sad thing, you know, when you see like very physically impressive men become aged, it's kind of sad in a way.
Okay. Explain.
Maybe there's just something about like watching people deteriorate.
Yeah, I suppose it's more noticeable when they were
so, you know, powerful.
Like he's obviously, he's still
well old.
Holds his own in there. Yeah.
But he just looked very mortal to me, not like I'm used to seeing him, because he normally looks like a wrestler who's, you know, immortal, kind of the showcase of the immortals. And then you've got that scene where they have that really tense dialogue in the living room. He's obviously there to, well,
yeah.
Kay is hoping to apprehend him, Kay, Ryan Gosling's character, but Sapper Morton, Batista's character, is not up for going quietly. And then just even that fight scene, like they shot it from, you've got a bit where he's banging his head into a wall, but instead of seeing a close-up of him banging his head into a wall, you see it from the other side as the wall gradually caves in and then they come crashing through. And then they have that kind of bit of almost funny dialogue where Kay's managed to get the upper hand, which showcases how strong he is as a new series kind of replicant. So he's overpowered this great big brute, and then he's kind of like, oh, but he's just kind of choking. And Kay's like, don't get up. And then he does, so he shoots him. But the camera lingers on Kay's face instead of showing Batista crumpling to the ground. I just thought all the decisions around the shots and the positioning of the camera and everything was just perfectly done.
Yeah. I suppose, speaking of kind of, you know, the cinematography, if you will, when I said a minute ago about the whole special effects thing and, it, you know, could it just be this big action film? Well, actually, it is a really visually impressive film, and it's so much so that, and it sounds really good as well, to the point where I would be tempted to buy this on like a 4K Ultra Blu-ray DVD, because it does look and sound really good, and it, and that enhances the film. Sometimes it takes it away, doesn't it? We talked about It Chapter 2 a while ago, when they threw all these special effects in there and it was just made it shit. But this time, everything they've done visually and audio-ly.
Because it's necessary. Because it's depicting a world that couldn't be depicted without the use of that technology. So instead of it being
pointless, it's a film about technology.
Yeah.
So it benefits, therefore, you know, makes from sense that it use. Would benefit from its use, making it. So,
and we do
but
get,
that opening scene, I did. Just when you were talking about it, I just remembered the sound effects, how kind of impressive they were, particularly at the cinema, obviously.
Yeah, it was great. I think I never go to the cinema to watch the same film more than once, hardly ever, because it's like, well, I could watch a new film, so why would I watch the same one? I think I went 3 times to watch this.
Wow, really?
Because I just thought it was so good. And I did. I think I probably was quite annoyingly giving it all the, oh, it's amazing, you've got to see it. But I just, I was like a big evangelist for it after I came out.
I think ever since Drive as well, I've always really liked Ryan Gosling.
Me too.
So, yeah.
He's some people are not that struck on him, but I like him. I think he's I know he always plays those quite similar characters, that like sort of
quiet
stoic man of few words. But it really fits this role, so it's good. Good casting.
Bit like Tom Hardy in films,
yeah,
kind of does that quite well.
He does. I do think he's probably more versatile than Gosling, but I do like Gosling in this film, and he has a cool coat. So
we
didn't mention the cool coats in the first Blade Runner. There are some big collars, and this one lives up to the legacy.
That is true.
Wish I had one. Yeah, and casting again, you know, we talked about the great casting in the first one. This one has got some really good, you know, Batista does a great job. Gosling is excellent. This is Harrison Ford's best performance for decades in this film, I really think. Like, I know he only comes in quite late in the film, but we get this real kind of vulnerable, determined kind of tough guy, but he's obviously sad and bitter about the way it's all turned out, that he's had to basically kind of forsake any kind of relationship with his child in order to protect them. And then there's that scene where he's confronted by Jared Leto's character, Nyander Wallace, who's a real disgusting, grotesque piece of shit. He's maybe a bit over the top, but, you know, he's pretty horrible. He does his job as a villain. And he's got, like, Rachel's skull in his lap, hasn't he? That he just kind of whips the towel off it halfway through the chat. And Ford looks noticeably kind of shaken. He's kind of tearing up. I thought that scene was great.
Yeah, I agree. And Leto, another one I have a just weird soft spot for. I just like him in most things.
And the sort of CGI / lookalike combo special effects in that scene when Wallace presents Deckard with a fake replica, a replica of a replicant, but it's a Rachel clone. That was, I know it's kind of quite commonplace now. We've seen it with like Princess Leia in the Star Wars films and it's a bit creepy. But the fact that it looked a bit creepy and slightly Uncanny Valley...
Kind of worked.
Exactly. Yeah. Perfect. I remember just being like stunned, horrified on Deckard's behalf when she came strolling in.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah, I didn't think of it like that. It sort of works in the film's favour, doesn't it? Maybe accidentally or not, I don't know. But yeah, it does. Happy accident.
Yeah, it was almost like the first time, 2017, the first time most of us had seen the CGI resurrection of it. She's not dead, by the way, Sean Young, but she's obviously loads older. You know, the resurrection of a much younger character. But it was right for it to be creepy, because the whole scene was fucking creepy.
Yeah.
And then he gives it that... her eyes were green. And then she just gets blown away by the best thing in the film, which is the character Love, the Nyander Wallace's replicant assistant.
Yeah.
She is absolutely brilliant. I should say which actress it is, and to my shame, I can't remember. Let me just find that out. Love is played by... Sylvia Hooks, I think is the pronunciation of that. Dutch name, I think. She is like a revelation in that film. She's like a, you know, like a kind of pampered, like an executive assistant who's getting her nails done, but she's also like really ruthless.
Yeah.
Really snappy, like real high fashion clothes and like handbags, but she'll also crush a glass into your hand and stab you to death. Like, I think she's brilliant.
What's she done since?
I've never seen her in anything else, and I'm sad because I think she's really good. The Girl in the Spider's Web 2018, which I haven't seen.
No, I've not seen that.
And there's lots of other many other big names in the film. You've got Ana de Armas, who plays the hologram girlfriend. You've got Mackenzie Davis, who plays the prostitute who went on to be in the Terminator film that we talked about.
And she was good in that.
She was the best thing in that film.
Yeah. In fact, you could kind of compare her breakout performance as this kind of badass with Love.
Yeah, with Sylvia Hooks' performance as like a badass kind of ass kicker. Yeah, you were right. That is true. Like real strong kind of female cast. But yeah, that's one of the many strengths of this movie. I'll tell you what is interesting. You may disagree with this. I think the plot of Blade Runner 2049 is a load of bollocks about a missing child and, oh, it's almost like the Immaculate Conception, a replicant gave birth. The more I watch it, the more I think, nah, doesn't really work for me. I'm not really convinced by this replicant uprising kind of story. It didn't really do it for me.
Do you know what? That is kind of a good point. Because I've never really thought about either film in terms of what's really going on, because I just, obviously not the first time when I was drunk and asleep in the cinema, but I just kind of enjoyed the experience of watching. Do you know what I mean? It's everything around it that's just good.
Yeah.
To the point where the plot is the actual, finer details of the plot, it kind of a little bit not unnecessary, but just not that important.
Correct. And it was, so it wasn't that, it wasn't never, that,
you're right, it is kind of a bollocks.
Like, the characters were stronger than the plot, and the delivery was so kind of straight-faced and serious and inviting you to really kind of invest in this melancholy, bleak world. That actually, if what they were doing and the MacGuffin that they were searching for, which is this missing child, was this kind of bollocks, it was really just an excuse for this like series of brilliant set pieces. And I don't just mean action set pieces, just set pieces in general. Like, there's that bit where Kay, as a replicant kind of police officer, he has to undergo that baseline test. That is, you know, when they're kind of saying weird shit to him and he has to kind of respond, and it's like, incels interlinked, when you're off duty, do they keep you in a little box, interlinked. It was so good, that bit. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Cells. Have you ever been in an institution? Cells. Do they keep you in a cell? Cells. When you're not performing your duties, do they keep you in a little box? Cells.
Interlinked.
What's it like to hold the hand of someone you love? Interlinked. Do they teach you how to feel finger to finger? Interlinked. Do you long for having your heart interlinked? Interlinked. Do you dream about being interlinked?
Interlinked.
What's it like to hold your child in your arms? Interlinked. Do you feel that there's a part of you that's missing? Interlinked. Within cells interlinked. Why don't you say that three times? Within cells interlinked. We're done.
It's kind of like a video game, isn't it? Because most video games, the plot, it's kind of bollocks, but it's what you do in the game and where it's set, that's kind of the good part. And yeah, it's kind of the same, really.
Me and my other half sometimes have this debate about idea versus execution. Yeah. And I'm an advocate for like, oh, you've got to have a really good idea. And as long as the idea is original and clever and good, then even if the execution is a bit low budget or a bit flawed, then it doesn't matter. And she's like, no, the execution is important, because even if the idea is crap, if you deliver it really well and it's well shot, well directed, in the case of films, obviously this applies to anything, then that's the main thing. And this film supports her argument to me.
Yeah. But I think there's arguments to be made on both sides, though. I completely agree. Because when you were putting your side forward then, I thought, yeah, you're right. But actually, in this film, it's the opposite, isn't it?
I think so. And like, culminating in that amazing...
Because I've seen loads of films and read books that are like, just the premise is so good that you can kind of ignore the fact that it's kind of a bit of a crap film, but it's intriguing enough. And maybe, even when we were talking about the Halloween films and stuff, there are lots of films that just ignore this bit of kind of saying
I agree with you, though.
Gone replicant.
Maybe both are true. There are films that have a great premise and you'll forgive lots of crap delivery, crap acting or whatever. And there are films that have a rubbish, tired old, hackneyed premise but are really well executed, and both are good for completely different reasons. And sometimes you get a film that's both and they're really, really extra good.
Sometimes neither.
And sometimes,
and they're sometimes quite funny.
Yeah, exactly. And then one example of those is Wanted, Dead or Alive, starring Rutger Hauer.
Terrible film, but quite funny.
Remember when he catches the villain at the end, and then he has a chance.
Who's played by Gene Simmons, by the way.
Which is Gene Simmons. And he has to... he's really angry with this villain for whatever reason, and he's about to kill him. And then, is it the villain or is it like his boss or somebody, whoever's there, shouts out like, don't kill him, you won't get your bonus. And then Nick goes like, fuck the bonus. And then shoves a grenade in the guy's mouth.
In his mouth, yeah.
Makes him swallow a grenade and then he blows up.
I thought it was a knob of butter at first, but it was a grenade.
He shoves some toast into it, yeah. And the final thing I was going to say was just in terms of like brilliant set pieces, atmospheric, great, well shot. There's that fight sequence between Kay and Love on that, the side, sort of the base of that kind of dam.
That is really good. Yeah,
and they're like, she's kicking his head in and stabbing him, and he basically strangles her and holds her underwater till she's dead. And I just like that whole bit, the waves are like lapping against the side of that crashed vehicle. I just thought that whole bit was brilliant.
Sorry, I just put it on. I went to find it, see if it was on YouTube, and it just burst through my headphones. But yeah, you can find that scene. It's just been great. That as a clip on itself on YouTube if you want to see what we're talking about.
And she gives away, there's almost that like her character is quite hard to fathom because she seems to be like completely loyal to Nyander Wallace, but she also cries when he kills what he views as a kind of failed new replicant, you know, when that woman kind of plops out of that plastic bag. Like, brilliant. Again, no CGI, none of that bollocks. She just dumped out of a bag. And then he decides she's kind of not worthy because she's unable to bear children. So he just kind of knifes her and she's dead. And love kind of sheds a tear. So you're almost like, well, why is she so subservient to this arsehole if she cares about the fate of her kind?
Yeah.
But then when she thinks she's killed Gosling, she says, I'm the best one. And it's like, oh, she views Wallace as genuinely as her creator and her kind of messiah figure, and she aspires to be in his favourite, like his number one creation. Like, it's almost like quite pathetic and sad.
Yeah.
Think that's it. Think that's the end of me pitch.
Well, one other thing I was going to bring up, just on the whole cyberpunk theme, not only do we have your excellent novel coming out, it'll already be out by now, but the cyberpunk video game as well coming out this year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm really lucky there. It's not like I bloody wrote a cyberpunk book because I knew that the term would be getting Googled a lot, but I'm hoping to just shamelessly piggyback off off the back of that, because it's a big old game release starring only bloody Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, wow.
I wonder if there'll be any surprise little...
other people in it.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, same. Like... yeah, the video games industry is so big now, it can afford to keep things up its sleeve, can't it? It doesn't have to showcase all of its trump cards to get you to buy the product, because everyone's going to bloody buy it anyway.
Well, they're doing basically what Rockstar does. They're kind of just drip feed the information.
Yeah.
And so, like, any new reveal is like a big deal.
Yeah, it just drums up another wave of kind of interest. It's very clever marketing.
Whilst other
strategy.
Games, you know, have to really, like, plug away every week to remind you that they're coming.
It's even like Streets of Rage 4, like we were talking before we started recording. We were talking about Streets of Rage 4, which was released today time of recording, which we've played and is ace. But that has got a notable returning character from the earlier games. But instead of that being a really brilliant surprise, it's like they told you and they announced it because they want to sell more copies. And I get why. Don't blame them, but it's a shame. It's imagine how cool that surprise would have been.
Hey, cyberpunk.
Streets of Rage.
Kind of.
I had this. I'm on a cyberpunk Facebook group, and I put Streets of Rage on, and loads of people agreed, and loads of people disagreed.
Really? Yeah.
There you go. There's a fella in it with metal arms. Like,
I was
going to
say,
know.
Yeah. There's Streets of Rage 3. They're all bloody replicants.
Robots. Yeah, exactly. So I think,
and isn't Axel? He's a copper, isn't he?
Axel's a cop, so you've got a detective.
Detective, yeah.
Robot arms all over the place. You've got some
neon
lit shithole city called
raining a lot.
Wood Oak City, it's Wood called. Oak, yeah. Just, I don't know why it's called that, but yeah.
There you go. Yeah, cyberpunk. Okay, so anything else you wanted to add, or is that your pitch to other?
I will summarise by saying, in my pitch to t'other, that Blade Runner is worthy of a place in the Hall of Fame because it basically created an entire genre of dark fiction, a host of tropes that are still completely, you know, ubiquitous today in gritty science fiction detective stories. It is generally regarded as one of the best films ever made, you know, regularly gets into top 10 type lists. Brilliant performances, career-making performances for people like Rutger Hauer, best ad-lib of all time, and a genuinely a compelling story about a guy who has to hunt down some escaped artificial humans that manages to also be a really moving, sad story about, you know, what is the nature of life and consciousness, and then a sequel that only a sliver of a handful of sequels over the years has actually maybe not surpassed the original, but as a pair, it manages to elevate both of them and is a must-see for any fans of the original who haven't got around to watching it yet.
Okay. Does it deserve a spot? Hell no! No, no, of course it does. Gets in, it's in.
Hey!
Welcomed in with open arms.
I mean, whether it wants to be in...
Well, yeah.
...is a different question, but, well...
excellent film. And we didn't really mention the Philip K. Dick novel. It's sort of
got complete omission.
Which I didn't get on with.
I've read it. I've got it. It's good as a novel in its own right. All the Philip K. Dick stuff is good, compelling, weird, bonkers, written in the 60s. But it's just completely different from the film, isn't it? Just like Roy Batty is this really kind of pathetic character in it, and Deckard is this like much more kind of superior kind of killing machine. So yeah, completely different feel to the story, I thought.
I read it years ago and I just didn't resonate with me, man. But the film certainly did, and that's why they're in the Hall of Pain.
Yeah, in fact, as we were saying, like, it, you know, one of the few very, very good sequels is also one of the few book-to-movie adaptations where the movie is better than the book, and it really is.
I'm sure some people would disagree with that, but no, I think you're right, yeah. I think you're right, mate. You're always right. That's why everything you've ever pitched has always managed to get in.
Hey, you too. You too. Hey. You snap.
Thank
Jinx.
You.
Jinx. We've got a good track record so far.
So there you go, then.
Hopefully you won't screw it up on our next show when you pitch some, you know, whatever bollocks it's going to be.
That would be a shock, wouldn't it?
Hey. Well, let's hope people stop on bio to find out what you're going to be pitching.
You prick.
It'll be really rapturous.
There you go. Wait and see, guys.
Wait and see.
Okay.
Under the water good show it's going to be.
Please stop. There you go. Anything else you want to say?
Nope.
This is the bit where we struggle to end.
Go on, you. I will leave it to you to come up with our sign-off that we're going to adopt forever. So whatever you say next, we're going to say it forevermore now, and that's it. Done. That's it. That'll do. Thank you for listening, everybody, to another edition of Dark Natter. If you enjoyed the show and you want to support us, you can do so by leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast listening service, or even better, by just telling your friends, family and fellow dark fiction connoisseurs all about us. You can also follow us on social media, where you'll find us on Instagram at Dark Natter Podcast or on Twitter at @dark_natter. I mentioned earlier in the show that I have a new book out, so if you are a fan of cyberpunk thrillers, dystopian dark fiction, or even just good old-fashioned noir detective stories, then please don't hesitate to seek out London 2039 Auxiliary on Amazon. Or you can head over to www.john-richter.com. That's JONRICHTER. I will leave you now with a short audio excerpt from the book, which will give you a bit of a taste of what awaits you inside. Thank you once again, and bye for now. He frowned as she pushed open the door. The apartment was similar to Ambrose's, similar to his own, similar to everyone's. A soulless cube for human storage. The bulb in the hallway was a low wattage, as though the occupant was photophobic. Maggie sucked on her e-cigarette again as she led them towards the door to what turned out to be the living room. Still frowning, Dremler followed her inside. The room was surprisingly large, but any sense of space was undermined by the amount of mess that had accumulated within it. Too much furniture had been crammed in, and ornaments adorned every available surface. Chairs were covered with piles of clothes, the walls dominated by shelves full of ancient books, CDs and DVDs. Whoever lived here was clearly a retro enthusiast. Drimler couldn't make out the titles of the archaic volumes because the living room was even darker than the hall. The fitting and bulb from the central light had shattered into fragments strewn across the wooden floor. The illumination came instead from a pair of portable spotlights that had been set up and aimed at the wall as though pointed towards a performer taking centre stage. But this was not a live show. It was a tableau. Maybe the most brutal he'd ever seen. A woman's head had been crushed into the wall, which had cracked and crumbled around it. She was suspended about a foot from the floor by the arm of her attacker, a muscular titanium HET prosthetic, its fingers clamped tightly around her face. The limb had been severed at the shoulder and was left jutting straight out into the room, as though the woman had died wearing some sort of bizarre headgear. She was slim and dressed in gym clothes. He tried to imagine her face in life, but could only picture the mangled ruin that was doubtless hidden beneath the palm of the mechanical appendage that had killed her. Clumps of her dark hair protruded between its fingers, dark blood oozing out and drip, drip, dripping onto the floor.